Hi, everybody. Welcome to our call this morning, afternoon, that we're going to be discussing findings from a new report that MPI has just released. It's called Extending New Relief to Unauthorized Immigrants, Estimating the Impacts of Possible Executive Action. My name is Michael Fix. I am the president of the Migration Policy Institute, and let me start with some of the housekeeping stuff. First, let me take this opportunity to remind everybody that the call is being recorded and the audio and the PowerPoint from the webinar will be on our website later today. This, and you need to read it, nine-page report is available at www.migrationpolicy.org. If you have any technical problems, please email events@migrationpolicy.org. or call 202-266-1929. The best browsers to access the webinar are Google Chrome and or Firefox. If you have problems hearing via the web, please dial in using the call information you sent to you via email earlier. We're going to have a Q&A at the end of the call, so please feel free to type any questions into the chat box on the left side of your screen or email your questions to, again, events@migrationpolicy.org, events@migrationpolicy.org. Now, our speakers today are two of the authors of the report that we recently released, Randy Capps, a demographer and the director of research for U.S. programs here at the Migration Policy Institute, and Mark Rosenblum, the deputy director of our U.S. Immigration Policy Program. With that, let me plunge straight in. The brief we're releasing today examines a range of strategies for possible executive action that could offer some relief to the unauthorized. The proposals we're going to be discussing have been publicly advanced by members of Congress, by immigrant advocates, and by others, and we hope that the findings provide some sense of the impacts of differing pathways that the Obama administration may take when some form of executive action may eventually be announced. The analyses that underlie the report lie at the intersection of a number of MPI's areas of work that many of you know. First, our estimates of the impact of the DACA program. Our most recent report here was released in August, and it was on the second anniversary of the DACA program's initiation. Second band of work is our work on prosecutorial discretion and border and interior enforcement, and you should know here that we are will soon release a major report analyzing ICE data from 2003 to 2013 that examines removals across administrations. Mark Rosenblum will be discussing some of the findings from that report in a few minutes. A third strand of our work is a partnership that we have with Temple and Penn State Universities to create new demographic techniques for estimating the size and the composition of the unauthorized population. They're the basis for many of the numbers that we'll be discussing this morning, and as you'll notice, Jim Bachmeyer, one of the paper's authors, is a professor of sociology at Temple and has been instrumental in developing these methodologies. The basic demographic innovation here has been to link the Census's survey of income and program participation, which quite helpfully asks whether respondents have a green card, to link it to the Census's main workhorse, the American Community Survey, which gives us both current data, reasonably current data, and reasonably broad geographic coverage. Our analyses basically probe three areas of potential executive action. First, adjusting the parameters of the existing DACA program announced on August 2012. Second, creating new DACA-like programs that extend relief to differing populations, for example, parents of U.S. citizens in the U.S. 10 years or more, or unauthorized parents or spouses of U.S. citizens over 21 years old who would qualify for a green card but for the 3- and 10-year bars introduced by the 1996 Immigration Act. And third, going beyond efforts to, if you will, regularize group legal status, we examine what the impacts might be of guidance that would narrow ICE's enforcement priorities so fewer people might be deported. As I've said here, our focus is on actions that would affect the nation's 11 million plus undocumented immigrants. They do not include, for example, administrative or regulatory changes that might increase the number of immigrants entering under employment programs or other possible reforms. Our bottom line, the reforms vary widely in their reach, with time of residence in the United States being a particularly critical factor in the different proposals' potential impact. So with that, let me turn the floor over to Randy Capps.
Okay, thank you, Michael, and I want to thank everyone for joining the call. The first set of numbers we are looking at are modeling changes in the program eligibility rules for the existing DACA program. As Michael mentioned, about 3 weeks ago, we released a report that estimated the eligible population for DACA under the current rules at about 1.2 million. That doesn't include people who could age into the program when they reach age 15. It might not include a few people who may be eligible through participation in adult education, but that's our best estimate of the currently eligible population as of 2012. Now, we modeled several changes to the program rules. As a reminder, what the current rules are, individuals have to have arrived in the United States by 2007 and have 5 years of continuous residence through 2012. They have to have arrived under the age of 16. They have to be between the ages of 15 and 30, and they have to have at least a high school education or equivalent or currently be enrolled in school. So the first few lines of this table show, if we change those program rules with minor adjustments, how many more people we estimate would be eligible for the program. If we change the year of arrival from 2007 to 2009, that is from 5 to 3 years of continuous residence, that would add about 50,000 people to the pool of potentially eligible DACA beneficiaries. If we changed it to 2011, that is 1 year of continuous residence, that would add about 100,000 people. If we changed the age at arrival from under 16 to under 18, that is allowed those that arrived at ages 16 and 17 to participate in the program, this could extend eligibility to about 200,000 more people. Eliminating the maximum age of 30 would also extend eligibility to about 200,000. A broader change would be to eliminate the education requirement altogether, the requirement of a high school degree or equivalent or school enrollment, and that would affect about 400,000 people. So these would be individual program rule changes. It is also possible that the administration might consider changing more than one of these rules at a time, and so we modeled a few combinations, including eliminating the maximum age and changing the year of arrival to 2011, and that's about 300,000 people, eliminating the maximum age and changing age at arrival, and that's about 500,000 people, and then eliminating, changing all three of these rules simultaneously, which would add about 700,000 people. Now, the broadest sort of possible expansion would be to eliminate the education requirement, which of course is kind of at the core of the program, but is possible, and these other changes at the same time, and that would add substantial numbers to the eligible pool, up to almost 2 million people, to bring the total DACA eligible population to 3.1 million. Now, the second set of changes that we looked at involve establishment of a deferred action program along the same lines as DACA for other populations of the unauthorized immigrants with other characteristics. And here we relied on media reports of what the Obama administration might be considering. We don't know anything that the general public doesn't know about the timing or what options might in the end be chosen. So we modeled a few of what we thought were the most commonly discussed in the media. And that includes changes modeled along the lines of how long people have been in the United States, whether or not they have family members, that is children or spouses, who are U.S. citizens, lawful permanent residents, or LPRs, in other words, or DACA beneficiaries. And then this group that Michael alluded to, that some have referred to as parole in place, people who might already be eligible for green cards as immediate family members of U.S. citizens, that is, as spouses of U.S. citizens or parents of adult children who are U.S. citizens, ages 21 and over. And the concept here is that these are people who could apply for these green cards and receive them were it not for the fact that they cross the border illegally, they have to leave the United States to apply for green cards, and they're barred for 3 or 10 years, depending on their length of illegal residence in the United States, from applying. Dropping, the effect of dropping those bars might legalize a substantial number of people immediately. Now, the administration doesn't have the authority to do that on their own, but they may be considering a parole in place until such time Congress makes those changes. So, again, one of the most important dimensions to consider that we highlight in the report is how long people resided in the U.S., and this has a large impact on how many people would qualify for a new or expanded deferred action program, no matter what the other parameters of it are. So in this slide, we look at the total population of unauthorized immigrants that we do not have in our eligible pool for DACA. I'll explain how we got this number in a minute. That's 10.5 million. Of this 10.5 million, 8.5 million have been in the U.S. at least 5 years, 5.7 million at least 10 years, and about 3 million at least 15 years. So there is a core of the unauthorized population that's substantial, that's been here for a very long time, but it is a relatively small share of the total. Now, if we look at some of the specific scenarios that have been discussed in the media for a new deferred action program, we modeled several of these in this table. To begin with, we start with an estimated total unauthorized population of 11.7 million. This is based on Pew Research Center's estimate for 2012 that was released last year. Again, that's 11.7 million. We subtract 1.2 million immigrants that we estimate are eligible for DACA to get 10.5 million immigrants not eligible for DACA. Of those, 3.5 million are parents of U.S. citizens under the age of 18. In other words, parents with minor children who are citizens residing in their households. Because it's a household-based survey that we used, we couldn't accurately model those who are older, 18 or older. Some of them are in the household and some are not. We also include parents of LPRs and parents of DACA eligible to bring the total up to 3.7 million. And it's worth noting here that adding in parents of LPRs or DACAs in addition to parents of U.S. citizen children doesn't really increase the eligible group all that much. And the reason for this is that most of these parents also have U.S. citizen children in their home. The typical profile of many of these families is to have a younger child who's a U.S. citizen and an older child who's a non-citizen who may be a green card holder or DACA eligible. If we look at that 3.7 million parents of U.S. citizens, LPRs, or DACA eligible, we can see that the large majority, almost 3.5 million, have been in the country at least 5 years, but that number declines rapidly to just 2.5 million, at least 10 years, and just under 1.5 million with at least 15 years of residence. So the profile of residents is a little bit different with parents than the total unauthorized population. They're more established. Of course, having families is a signal of being more established. But again, after 10 years, the numbers who would be eligible declined substantially. We separately modeled unauthorized spouses of U.S. citizens, LPRs, or DACA eligible, about 750,000 are spouses of U.S. citizens, and another 750,000 are spouses of LPRs or DACA eligible. Again, the total number who could be eligible for deferred action changes significantly with longer U.S. residence requirements. Then finally, we looked at the overlap between these two groups, and there is some overlap between unauthorized parents and unauthorized spouses, and we come up with a total of about 4.3 million who are either parents or spouses of U.S. citizens, LPRs, or DACA-eligible children. And again, this number declines to 1.6 million with the 15-year residency requirement. Now, the narrower and more focused group, if you will, again, I referred to this earlier as the parole in place group, is the group that would be eligible for a green card as immediate relatives of U.S. citizens were it not for the 3 and 10-year bars on their admissibility. This includes one group that we showed earlier in the previous slide that's close to 800,000 unauthorized spouses of U.S. citizens. And then we separately estimated how many parents of U.S. citizen adults ages 21 and older and came up with 600,000. There's some overlap in this group, so our best estimate is 1.3 million unauthorized spouses or parents of adult children who could qualify for green cards were it not for the 3- and 10-year bars. Now, of course, there are other groups of unauthorized immigrants who could qualify for green cards were it not for these bars. There's, you know, the adult siblings and the other preferences, even employment-based. We didn't model these. These are groups that would have to potentially wait a number of years to receive their green cards in any case. And so with that, I will move it on to the next slide, which focuses on narrowing the enforcement priorities, and turn it over to Mark Rosen.
Thanks, Randy. So as Michael mentioned, this part of the brief comes from a longer MPI report that will be released in a few weeks. What that report and what this part of the brief are based on is ICE administrative data that were obtained by the New York Times through a Freedom of Information Act request. And the New York Times made the data available to MPI as well as to some other researchers. And what the data consists of is a record of every formal removal executed by ICE between 2003 and 2013, about 2.9 million removal cases. And the data include information about individuals' immigration histories and their criminal enforcement histories, and we're able to use the data to evaluate on a case-by-case basis whether a given removal was consistent with DHS enforcement priorities that were described by ICE in a June 2010 memo that was written by then ICE Director John Morton, the so-called Morton memo. And what that memo described is three priorities: people who have been previously convicted of a crime, so that's any removable immigrant who's been previously convicted of any crime; recent illegal entries, and that's defined as anyone who entered the U.S. within the last 3 years; and so what the memo describes is immigration obstructionists, and essentially that includes anyone who's been previously ordered deported or anyone who's failed to appear for an immigration hearing. So what we did in this analysis is evaluate for all of ICE's removals during this time period how many of the removals were consistent with the administration's current enforcement priorities and how many fell outside these categories. So the analysis allows us to describe how many fewer removals would have resulted if DHS only deported people who met one or more of its enforcement priorities, and that's what we show in this table. So what you can see in the first row of the table is that most removals that have occurred between 2003 and 2013 do fall into one or more of DHS's existing enforcement priorities. And specifically what we found is that if DHS had strictly adhered to the current enforcement priorities by only deporting people who fell into one of those priority categories, it would have resulted in 191,000 fewer removals during the 11-year period that we looked at. So that's only about a 7% reduction compared to the 2.9 million the 2.9 million ICE removals that actually occurred. And then the other thing we're able to do with this analysis is to model how many people would have been removed if DHS consistently adhered to a modified set of enforcement priorities, and in particular, if the enforcement priorities were defined more narrowly to prioritize fewer people for removal, as some people have proposed. That's, you know, one of the strategies that's been proposed for executive action. So what the remainder of this table does is go through several different scenarios. For example, in the next row of the table, if instead of identifying anyone previously convicted of any crime as an enforcement priority, if that category were redefined to say to exclude traffic offenses from, you know, to no longer call traffic offenses an enforcement priority, that would have reduced the number of priority removals by 15,000. So instead of 191,000 fewer, we would see 206,000 fewer removals. And if the criminal category were redefined to no longer focus on any nonviolent crimes, the reduction in removals would increase to 433,000. And then the next couple of rows look at changes to the other enforcement priority categories. Redefining recent illegal entries from 3 years to 1 year would result in 232,000 fewer removals. Changing the definition of immigration obstructionist to no longer focus on long-standing removal orders, but to only focus on more recent removal orders. One of the things that you'll see from these numbers, some of these estimates are perhaps smaller than you might expect, or they were smaller than I expected when I began looking at these data, and that's for a couple of reasons. One reason is that most people who fall into one of these enforcement priorities actually fall into more than one of the categories identified in the Morton memo. So, for example, most people who are removed after being convicted of a crime are also either recent illegal entrants or have previously been formally removed, so-called immigration obstructionists. So changes to any one of these categories have a smaller impact than changes that encompass multiple categories. It's a similar finding to what Randy mentioned above with respect to DACA, that if an executive action touches more than one of these priorities at once, that would have a much larger impact. And so the last four rows in the table explore some of these scenarios in which multiple changes would be made to the existing enforcement priority categories. And what you can see, the sort of largest scenario that we looked at in the last row of the table is if the definition of criminals who are prioritized were changed to only focus on people convicted of violent crimes, and DHS were to redefine their focus on recent legal entries to people who entered in just the previous 1 year, and they were no longer to prioritize long-standing, you know, more than 10-year-old removal orders, that would result in 538,000 fewer removals over the last 11 years. The second reason that these numbers look a little bit smaller than the deferred action numbers that we were discussing above is that in this case, we're looking at actual historical removals, not the total pool of people potentially affected by changes to the enforcement priorities. In general, many people who could potentially fall into these categories or not fall into these categories would not be directly affected by a change in enforcement priorities because they never enter the enforcement system, because they're never apprehended by DHS. So the pool of people potentially affected is smaller than the pool of people actually affected when we're talking about discretion exercised during the enforcement process. And it's sort of a basic difference between a deferred action program that would be based on applications that people would come forward and apply for versus enforcement that's exercised during, or discretion that's exercised during immigration enforcement that would only affect people who are apprehended by DHS. So to wrap up, let me reiterate that this report really doesn't make any attempt to anticipate what types of executive actions may be undertaken or when an announcement might come about that. What we've done instead is to flesh out the specific impact of three different types of reforms that, you know, are that may be being considered, that have been widely discussed in conversations about, you know, this executive action that may be coming. These possibilities are not mutually exclusive. More than one of these may be considered, and this is not an exhaustive list. It's just the ones that we had good data for and that we were able to model successfully. And so we focused on three different scenarios that may be under consideration, three different types of executive actions. One possibility is to expand the current DACA program for immigrant youth. A second possibility is to create a new deferred action program that would cover people not eligible for DACA. And a third possibility is to modify the existing enforcement priorities that DHS has uses to guide its current removal practices in ways that would result in fewer deportations among people who are apprehended by DHS. And some of the, you know, the ranges that we identify in the report are right here on this slide. And rather than read them to you,
I will pause there and we'll open it up. I guess, is Michael going to give some ground rules for Q&A?
Okay. Well, thanks, Mark. Thanks, Randy. Terrific presentations. Before we go to questions, I just wanted to say that, and this responds in part to one of the questions that we've heard, that we've gotten in, we will be posting next week, we will be posting data on our website on the number and characteristics of the DACA population in 111 counties, for 111 counties, and with profiles of the population in 36 counties. We'll be posting it on our website, www.migrationpolicy.org, so please watch that space. Currently, we have up data on the DACA population by state, by major state, on our website. And then I would also add to that, we're going to soon be releasing Mark Rosenblum's paper from which this presentation was partially drawn. The name of the paper is Deportation and Discretion, Reviewing the Record and Options for Change. So, again, watch this space for that report. And now we'll go to questions. So please email your questions, again, to events@migrationpolicy.org or use the chat functions. And let me apologize in advance for not being able to take all questions, but we'll get to as many as possible during our remaining time. We have a few in. We've already received a few, and I've passed them along to our brilliant speakers. So, Randy, why don't you get going with the two questions that you've got?
Okay, and the first question involves the first table, which I'm going to pull back up on the presentation. It may take a minute here. But it's the question is, in this DACA expansions table, is each category inclusive of the previous category? And the answer to that is no. The way this table is constructed, the first column of numbers starts with the estimated currently eligible population under the current DACA program rules. Then you have in the second column how many people would be added to the eligible population with any specific rule change and only the rule change that's listed on that table row. So there are a number of individual changes, and then the changes further down are cumulative, and that's where it would involve some of the previous changes. So that's the way we did that, so you could see the impact both of individual changes and combination of changes. The second question refers to the different sets of family relationships that we modeled in order to see what an expanded deferred action population might look like, and this applies, I think, both to the people who could be already eligible for permanent residency were it not for the 3 and 10 year bars, as well as the more general pool of parents and spouses. In both cases, the methodology that we use relies on a household survey, that household survey being the American Community Survey. We can assign likely unauthorized status to members of the household, and we can see who else is in that household. That would include a minor children and spouses. It doesn't include adult siblings. Most of the adult siblings we would hypothesize are not in the same households, and so we can't link individuals across households. So that's why we were unable to model potential eligibility for deferred action based on sibling relationships.
Thanks, Randy. Mark, I think you have a question there.
Sure. So the question, somebody asked for clarification on the definition of an LPR, which stands for lawful permanent resident, and that's a green card holder, somebody who's got a visa permission, a non-citizen with a visa or permission to live permanently in the United States, and generally somebody who has a lawful permanent resident visa after 5 years in the United States is eligible to apply to become a U.S. citizen if they pass the citizenship test. Those are also known as green card holders.
Good. Randy?
Yeah, there's another question on the eligibility, and this is an issue with our August numbers, and I think in general any numbers anybody's released so far on the DACA population as well as any deferred action expansions. There are actually two things that are difficult to model in this. This question regards criminal backgrounds. We don't have a good estimate for that. That is not something that's available in the American Community Survey. I know we've been scratching our heads about it, and others have as well, but it's very difficult to figure out what's the likelihood of disqualifying criminal convictions. And it's not just criminality in general. I mean, DACA is pretty specific, right, that it's got to be one felony, one major misdemeanor, or three or more misdemeanors. So it just it's really too difficult to model. We do understand that it could be a few percent of the population that could make our estimates of eligible populations a little bit on the high side, but probably not by very much. The other one that we didn't get a question about that we've discussed internally that we didn't model is continuous residence. All we know from the American Community Survey is when people said they came to live in the United States. They may have come and gone since that time. So obviously the longer that goes out, like the 5 year, we've heard from people who've done research in the field that proving 5 years of continuous residence for DACA is sometimes difficult. In fact, we've all heard most recently that USCIS is requiring documentation basically every 3 months during that 5 year period. You could imagine if you go out to 10 or 15 years that that would be even more difficult to prove continuous residence over that long a period of time.
We have a question here, a very interesting question about the possibility of expanding benefits eligibility to the DACA population and whether we have estimated what the costs and implications might be. This brings us back to the work, Randy, that you and I did around the exclusion of undocumented unauthorized immigrants from the ACA. And what we have done in an earlier paper and in a paper that was in an article that was published in Health Affairs is examine the size of the population that would be excluded, but I don't believe that we did actually a cost analysis of what the cost implications would be of their inclusion in the ACA or the extension of the ACA to unauthorized immigrants. It was a notable policy event when the DACA youth were excluded from ACA benefits, and that was followed by, you know, exclusion of legalizing immigrants in the Senate bill that was being proposed in 2012-2013.
But Michael, I think this is related also to a broader but also more technical, you know, legal issue, which is that the DACA confers a work authorization and relief from deportation. It doesn't confer a legal status. It doesn't put somebody into, you know, the qualified bucket for public benefits under current law. It doesn't even put them into a temporary legal status that puts them into the lawfully present category, you know, that's in the Affordable Care Act. So the DACA group and any other deferred action group wouldn't be eligible for federal health benefits of any, you know, sort other than those that are open to everyone, regardless of their legal status. So the degree to which that they could become eligible would be a state or local issue.
Great. And here's a question that we have an absolute answer to. Someone has asked, how can I get a copy of the Morton memo that Mark mentioned? I will just say that I've been doing my research since we got that question, and if you look in the footnotes, the end notes to the issue brief, which you can download, the Morton memo is cited with a URL in footnote 11. Mark, do you want to add?
Well, just that we also released a report back in April that Doris Meisner and I wrote that has some discussion of those. There's two Morton memos. And we have a fairly extended discussion of them if you want to look there as well.
All right, here's two questions. I can answer one of them, and Randy can take a shot at the other. First is, what does DACA stand for? Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And here's a question. How did you determine unauthorized status in the ACS?
Okay, and so that the second question is something that we could spend quite a bit of time on, but the brief answer is that the ACS has certain characteristics of immigrants that may be associated with their unauthorized status. It has what country they were born in, how long they've been in the United States, their age, their gender, their educational attainment, their occupation. And so what we did in collaboration with the demographers that Michael mentioned at the beginning is to take a look at the survey of income and program participation. It's a smaller survey. It was done in 2008, but it asked many of the same questions and many of the same characteristics of immigrants, again, such as age, country of origin, time in the U.S., are available in both surveys. But the SIP, the Survey of Income and Program Participation, additionally asked people if they have a green card. So it is possible to know that people who have a green card and people who don't have a green card in the SIP data have different characteristics. Using those characteristics that are common between the two surveys, we can assign probabilities that people are unauthorized to the ACS based, again, on those SIP green card answers. One other thing I should note is that we, before doing this process, separate out a number of people with temporary status, such as students, foreign workers like the H-1Bs and the Ls, and the TPS, Temporary Protected Status Group, and recent refugees.
Good. So here's a question that notes that we mentioned that we'll be releasing data and characteristics on the county level next week. Will we also be releasing major cities level data or characteristics as well? No, we won't. We're sorry. Could you explain the challenges to estimating city level populations?
Yeah, there are a lot of challenges to estimating small geographies, the first challenge of which is the boundaries available in the public use data of the ACS that we use are not always contiguous or the same as counties. I mean, states are quite easy. The counties, metropolitan areas, and cities are very complicated. They differ a lot depending on the size of the jurisdiction. And so even to match those boundaries across a large number of cities or counties or metropolitan areas is difficult. For us, we felt that counties were a good use of area of measurement because we know that certain major counties have very large unauthorized populations and that there are some metropolitan areas that are composed of several counties. We could have done it, I suppose, at the metropolitan area. It's more challenging because metropolitan areas span a number of counties and go across state boundaries in some cases. Cities are the most difficult, though, because they're the smallest geography and the most difficult to line up with those boundaries available in the micro data for in very many cases. So it is a complex thing to do, and I think the boundary side of it is one of the biggest issues. The other is, of course, sample sizes. When you get below a certain population level, the population of unauthorized individuals, and especially the DACA population, which is quite smaller, the samples become inadequate to really provide good estimates.
So here's a question. In your analysis of county-level DACA data, what have you found as the major drivers of the DACA application rate?
Well, I have a quick answer to that, which is that we've seen this in the state-level rates, and we noted in the report that we released in August that Arizona had the highest application rate. So there are some factors associated with that. One is a high Mexican origin population, a high Latino population in general, but specifically Mexican and Central American origin. We understand from fieldwork that others have done that there's been more outreach to Latino communities in general about DACA, and again, specifically Mexican origin and Central American, than other types of communities. So where you have a more diverse DACA population, if you will, the application rates tend to be a little bit lower. Also, we believe there may be an incentive to apply in a state like Arizona, where the risk of coming into contact with law enforcement and being deported is higher, where there is the legal Arizona Workers Act that may make it harder for an unauthorized immigrant to get a job, so getting the work permit is also more important. So those are some of the factors that we have looked at that might explain, for instance, a higher rate in Arizona than, say, New York.
One reason you might want to look at these county data is that the standard explications for higher or lower application rates, which is language, media, networks of local organizations, you know, political climate. When you go underneath the national level and look at the county level, there's some very interesting variation in terms of who comes forward in different places. In some of the sites that you can look at, you'll see that the South American population is very prominent, and others the Asian population is very prominent, much more prominent than at the national level. In Prince George's County and Montgomery County in Maryland, African populations are very prominent members of the DACA population. So some of the explications of why people are applying and why not, we'll need to revisit with this county data, with this very interesting county data in hand. All right, so we have one more. Is there a detailed description available for the methodology used in the ACS SIP imputation process, including state-level estimates?
Well, yes, the DACA report that was issued in the middle of August has a description and I believe a link to some previous reports in the notes as well. There will be some forthcoming academic publications that describe it in more detail. But I think that have those been published yet?
I think there's a publication forthcoming in Demography by Jennifer Van Hook, and then there's an article on the use of the SIP in the IMR, in the International Migration Review, by Jim Bachmeyer, Frank Bean, and by Jenny Van Hook, which underlie much of the methodology here. So another question here was, did we break down these models between Latino, Asian, and other potential beneficiaries? No, we didn't do for this analysis here today. Our earlier DACA work does break it down in those ways. Okay, so let me just thank our presenters for their excellent presentations. Let me thank the audience and thank them for their probing questions. And to conclude, let me just note the following. If there are any reporters on the call who have further questions, please call Michelle Mittelstadt at 202-266-1910. And as a reminder, the report, audio, and the slides from today's call will be available on our website later today at www.migrationpolicy.org. And if you have any additional questions, please feel free to email us. And thank you again so much for joining us today.
For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.